U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
White House counsel Don McGahn plans to leave the administration after the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. We'll tell you why he's been the president's, arguably the president's most important advisor and who might replace him in the White House. Plus, Senate hearings on Brett Kavanaugh. The president's Supreme Court nominee begin Tuesday with the judge making his first appearance likely on Wednesday. We'll tell you what to look for. Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal. Here with my peerless colleagues, Bill McGurn. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Paul.
And Kimberly Strassel. Kim?
Hey, Paul.
So let's talk about Don McGahn. He's the president's White House counsel. You might say long-suffering White House counsel in the sense that he has been in the cockpit for all of the turmoil illegally for this president. And yet, I think a lot of people that I know think that his departure, which was announced, the looming departure from the counsel job, was is going to be a loss for this White House. And the president announced it himself via tweet, surprising McGahn, who knew that he had worked out a departure, but thought it would be sometime announced sometime later. Trump, of course, does whatever he wants, so decided to announce it via tweet, thus making it a fait accompli after the Kavanaugh vote, which could happen as early as late September. And Kim, you know McGahn. You know him from the days when he was at the Federal Election Commission. And he really does get credit, enormous credit, for the president's judicial picks.
Yeah, count me among those who believe this will be a huge loss. If you look at President Trump's, what his victories have been, his main achievements, that's his remaking of the judiciary, it's his deregulation, and it's his tax reform. And Don McGahn is essentially the main architect of two of those, the deregulatory effort and the judiciary. And I don't think anyone can disagree with that point on the judiciary. Unprecedented number of circuit court nominees have made their way through. Obviously, we are on the cusp of a second Supreme Court Trump pick in Brett Kavanaugh. And Don McGahn's not only been the person pushing this and vetting these people, but he gets a lot of credit. And you heard even Democrats in the Senate praising the way in which the process has worked. He's not only helped choose very quality nominees, but made sure they were very well prepared, vetted, and that has allowed Chuck Grassley at the Judiciary Committee and Mitch McConnell, the leader, to really kind of march these people through and in a very short time put a very different stamp on the court system.
Just to put some numbers on that, Bill, in addition to two Supreme Court nominees, the White House has nominated, president has nominated 32 judges for the appeals courts, and 26 of them have been confirmed so far, six more likely to be confirmed before the end of this Congress. That's the most in a president's 2 years, if I have my math correct. And then the district courts, I think it's over 30 confirmed, right, and 77 still in the queue, also a very strong number.
And most of these men and women are in their 30s or 40s. So they're going to be handing down decisions when I've long since left this world. This is a huge reshaping of the courts. Look, there's a lot still on the courts. I mean, it's only like 12% of the courts, but it's a big, long-lasting change.
Well, just let me interrupt there once, Bill. There are 179 places on the appellate bench.
Court, right.
So if you have 32 of those in 2 right. years, you've replaced a lot.
Right. But it's still, it's still only a fifth.
Sure.
Now, the other thing is, I agree entirely with Kim. The other partner in this, of course, is Mitch McConnell. With a narrow majority in the Senate, kept the discipline and has been pushing these people through and creating the process to get them through quickly and not allow them to get dragged down and bogged down in hearings and so forth. It kind of shows you, I think, Kim's point about the Trump achievements. The best achievements are when he works with the establishment, is for a better lack of a better word, and agrees on a policy and carries it out. And this has been one of the best. I think Don McGahn is also a good model for a White House employee because you don't hear too much about him, right? I mean, he does his work, and it speaks for itself.
2 points, Kim. Quick points I want to make. Chuck Grassley, the Judiciary Committee Chairman, also gets a lot of credit for helping Mitch McConnell get these judges through. And the way that McGahn has worked with those two senators, and in addition to Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society in selecting from the pool of candidates that they have helped to vet for their judicial worldview, for their judicial jurisprudential philosophy, means that and vetted them in ethical terms. It's been a strong set of nominees, and they haven't had a lot of red flags raised about them. So the quality of those nominees has helped the Senate confirm them.
Well, absolutely. I think they've had maybe one had to step back, or a couple. There's been like two or three where something came up that was unexpected, or they pulled something out of their history that the left managed to turn into an issue that was enough that they made them step back. But this was crucial, especially Bill's point, a very narrowly divided Senate. And while Mitch McConnell has done a great job keeping Republicans on board, Chuck Grassley has done a great job of standing up against what has been unprecedented Democratic obstruction. And that has gone as far as, remember, the senators, this whole rule that they have where if you don't return your, is it the blue slip or it's
It's a blue slip.
Yeah, the blue slip, where a home state senator can object to a president's nominees. And the Democrats were absolutely abusing that process, and Grassley stood them down by making an executive decision and going back to the way that process used to work. But he does get a lot of credit, too, because if they had made their way with all of these objections, then we wouldn't see even half of these nominees confirmed so far. And just quick other point, too, on the deregulatory thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, Kim.
Yeah. It's not as if Don McGahn has been running that effort in the way that, say, Mick Mulvaney at the Office of Management and Budget, or Naomi Rao, who works there as well, too, on regulations. They're really in the thick of the day-to-day. But his influence has been in nominating some very aggressive general counsels, or helping put forward people within each of these agencies that have been scouring the books to get rid of basically unlawful actions that were taken by the Obama administration. Letters of guidance that were put out there rather than going through a formal rulemaking process, et cetera. And the goal of this has been not just to scrub the books of some of these things that are dubiously legally and get us back into a better situation in terms of how rules are made and promulgated correctly, but also to change the culture there so that hopefully even in future administrations, it's harder to go back to that kind of off the books rulemaking process.
The potential replacement for McGahn, scuttlebutt, one candidate, Emmett Flood, who is a former partner in Williams and Connolly, has been on the White House staff for at least 2 or 3 months now, playing the role of dealing with Robert Mueller, the special counsel. McGahn deputized Flood to do that. He has Flood had advised Bill Clinton on his impeachment. And I think would be Don McGahn's preferred choice, but the president, maybe because he found out that might be Don McGahn's preferred choice, decided to. He's interviewed a lawyer, D.C. litigator by the name of Pat Cipollone, or Cipollone, I guess. I'm not sure of the pronunciation. He is with the firm Stein Mitchell Cipollone and Cipollone, and practices commercial litigation. He did help, I think, with the debates, preparing Trump for the debates on legal issues. He, believe it or not, is the godfather to Laura Ingraham when her when she converted the Fox News host who, when she converted to Catholicism, had a godfather, and that was this gentleman. So I don't know a lot about him other than that and his judicial worldview, but it can't be easy to agree to work for this president. So especially at this moment, since the next 2 years could be, if Democrats take the House, could be really very difficult, Bill.
Yeah, look, I think Emmett Flood is very qualified. I'm more familiar with him than I am with the other man. I don't think there's anything wrong with interviewing a couple of candidates. I also think it's good to meet a president and have him talk, because if he doesn't trust you, doesn't like you, especially in this White House, it's not going to go well. When I was was asked to go work for President Bush before they made the offer, I had to go down there and meet with him and see, you know, if he would say yes. But it also shows progression in a White House. In the beginning, you start out with a lot of people from your campaign team, new people and so forth. But experience does matter at the end. You know, when you have problems, it does help to have someone who's been through the drill before.
We're talking about the White House staff for judicial selection, Donald Trump's general counsel, and the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
You can now listen to Potomac Watch on your Amazon smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal. From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Bill McGurn and Kim Strassel. And speaking of judicial nominees, Brett Kavanaugh begins his hearings in the Senate for confirmation for the United States Supreme Court next week. Bill, what do you expect?
Look, I think that the protests, you know, last week we had the sort of 2-minute hate against Brett Kavanaugh rallies around the country, and I think you and I agree this is basically a concession that he's going to be confirmed because he has the votes. We're probably going to see a few more handmade tail outfits and some, you know, breastfeeding and so forth. But, you know, Senator Schumer is getting my sympathy because he looks like he's going through the motions on this. And I'll just say one of the developments is the American Bar Association, I think, just gave Brett Kavanaugh its well-qualified rating, its highest rating. I think it's a sign that they know he's going to go in. I expect some of the Democrat senators running in these Trump states, when they see the Republicans are going to vote him in, will jump on that bandwagon.
If you couldn't give Brett Kavanaugh a well-qualified rating after having written 300 opinions for the D.C. Circuit and having, I think, more than 10 of them actually adopted in substantial part or whole by the Supreme Court, you couldn't give it to anybody. Him. So,
yeah, I think it says something more about the American Bar Association taking that long to get there than it does about Brett Kavanaugh.
I think the point is a good one, that part of the political shield for Kavanaugh throughout this process has been his qualifications. They haven't been able to lay a glove on him as somebody who is not up to the job. And once you've cleared that hurdle, then you're left with really ideological opposition that you don't agree with his judicial philosophy, or try to come up with some dirt, some ethical, something ethical in his background, which no doubt they've been digging but haven't been able to find. So he enters these hearings with a commanding position, Kim, and it will take something extraordinary, like a couple of missteps in the hearings or something we don't know about, a late hit, to stop him now.
Well, it would be very unexpected if they could lay a glove on him during these hearings either, for a couple of reasons. One is that he's been through this process before. He obviously had to go through hearings when he was appointed to the D.C. Circuit. And I believe, as Bill has said, that when he was in the White House, he participated in some of these murder boards, getting other Supreme Court nominees ready to face the grilling in the Senate. But also, too, because, you know, the reality is these hearings are usually nothing burgers. I think Elena Kagan once said that sitting for a Supreme Court hearing, it was one of the most vapid and hollow charades that a person could go through. And that's because, you know, all of the nominees know that there is no benefit in, you know, holding forth on their political or their judicial views and explaining how they would rule on cases. And in fact, pretty much ever since Ruth Bader Ginsburg set up the Ginsburg rule, which is she, during her own hearings, she said, I don't think it would be appropriate for me to say how I would rule on a case that would come in front of me. That's been pretty much the response of every nominee that has sat in front of the Senate since then. So they're not likely to get anything out of him during that. And as a result, what we're likely to see is this to be more political theater. Democrats, I think, knowing that they're not going to stop this, are going to use this national coverage instead and the cameras on him to wail about how bad it will be once he is on the court, the end of affirmative action and women's rights and Roe v. Wade and everything else, and try to motivate their base to come out in November.
The Senate has only itself to blame, Bill, in one sense, for the fact that if this is a charade, it's one they helped create, because when Robert Bork was nominated in 87 and decided to actually have a full debate and discussion of his judicial philosophy, he was destroyed for it and defeated.
Yeah, and you mentioned before, you know, who wouldn't give Brett Kavanaugh a good rating. I believe they downgraded Judge Bork's
rating. They said he was merely qualified.
One of the top jurists in the country. And the Democrats at the same time, in addition to having discredited themselves crying Bork for, you know, 30 years, they basically gave up their power by Harry Reid first dropping the filibuster for other nominees and then using it on Gorsuch. I think they would have been better to hold it in reserve and maybe try to use it for Brett Kavanaugh. But they're a disarmed minority now. They don't have anything there. I will say it's astounding to me that both Kim and you have overlooked the great character flaw in Brett Kavanaugh that's been unearthed, which is that he's a Washington Nationals fan. That seems to be the one thing they intend to use against him. It just looks like we're going through the motions. And, you know, you mentioned the hearings hearings that we don't really discuss. We discuss everything but the candidate's judicial philosophy. If you look at, I was looking at the Bork hearings and even the Scalia hearings, it's amazing how forthcoming they were about their philosophy and stuff. Far more. It would be nice to have that kind of debate.
Well, and it'd be interesting too, because with Kavanaugh, you would like to find out while he says, and I think he is an originalist, what kind of originalist?
Right.
There's a, as you know, debate in the conservative judicial community, legal community, about how aggressive you will be in overturning certain kinds of opinions, particularly those involving property rights precedents at the court, property rights and economic regulation. Some of our friends in the academy, Roger Pallone and Randy Barnett, you know, they'd like to go back, I think, and rethink some of the early 20th century cases. On the other hand, you've got judges who are more in the judicial restraint wing of the originalist movement. Where does Kavanaugh fall? That would be interesting to know. I don't think we do know, and I think that would be unveiled, Kim, over his tenure on the court.
Yeah, those would be the questions I would certainly be asking. I'd be fascinated to know the answer to that, you know, especially on issues, for instance, like campaign finance law or other First Amendment issues where, you know, the court has got a lot of opinions out there that not only I think a lot of people feel are wrongly decided unconstitutional in terms of free speech, but don't necessarily always square with prior ones that they've done. There's kind of a mess there at the top court, or racial admissions, for instance, and some of the court's prior rulings, admissions to universities, and whether or not you can use race as a criteria, some of the court's prior rulings. So I would love to know where he came out on the spectrum on some of these. You can get bits and pieces and gleanings from what he's written. But I think we could all agree, too, that he's likely to be a different kind of judge in some ways on the Supreme Court than he was at the D.C. Circuit, because we know he often wrote opinions in the D.C. Circuit that were designed, aimed at getting a Supreme Court to take notice and to adopt his arguments. But once at the top of the Supreme Court, he's just going to have a lot more freedom to express his judicial philosophy.
And I'll give you an example of that, Kim, because I think that's exactly right. On the case where he wrote the opinion that was later overturned on bonk at the D.C. Circuit on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, he aimed at the appointment clause and the fact that the president did not – that the president – that the head of the CFPB could not be fired except for cause. And Kavanaugh aimed his opinion on that. And the – I think a question I'd have is if he'd have felt – if he were on the Supreme Court and felt he had support for it, would he have been much more aggressive and said this whole structure of this – agency is unconstitutional the
exactly.
way it is constructed because it is not subjected to annual congressional appropriations. As we know, it is not constructed as a traditional agency like the SEC or the some of the other FCC. So I think he would have, but it's going to be interesting to find out.
He may get the chance. Some of these cases are going to the Supreme Court, and I think he may get the chance. This is really interesting. You were pointing about the distinctions. Justice Scalia, I think, wasn't quite as strong on some of this with the administrative state and so forth. I think he was moving in a different direction by the end of his life. But I think Brett Kavanaugh, who shares Justice Scalia's strong points about the separation of powers, a lot of that decision talks about that, I think would be more muscular in his application. And so he wrote the first opinion, right? And then it was overturned. And he may be on a Supreme Court that basically overturns that, too, because there are a couple of cases that are heading
that
their
are
way.
Moving their way. That's exactly right. Kim, last word.
One more point I would make, because it rounds back to Don McGahn, is that, you know, we've talked about the quality of the nominees that he's sent forward. One other thing that holds all these nominees together is they are this younger generation that has been brought up in the midst of some of these debates we were just talking about, and have been much more skeptical as a result. They've been influenced a lot more by the opinions of say, like a Clarence Thomas, much more influenced by some of the issues that the Federalist Society is really focused on. And so they are just generationally a different and more aggressive group of judges that seem more willing to go back past cases to knock down the power of the administrative state and the executive authority a little bit, at least in terms of domestic issues. And Kavanaugh being there could make an enormous distinction, not just in the majorities, but in, as you said, crafting even more aggressive opinions.
I sure hope that Jeff Toobin of The New Yorker and some of our friends at The New York Times aren't listening to this, Kim, because they're having heart palpitations now.
Very unhappy.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back next week with more editions of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.